Today at Reader's Corner, Robert Morgan, author of Lions of the West, Heroes and Villains of the Westward Expansion.
It is important to separate, insofar as you can, the legend, the folklore, from the fact. But it's also important to remember that the folklore is an important part of history. Nicholas Twist pulled off one of the great coups in American diplomacy. For $15 million, Twist bought half of Mexican territory. Thomas Jefferson believed that the future of the country was in its diversity. His vision of the country was, to a great extent, the one that became true.
I'm Bob Custer, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. In the early 19th century, the dream of Western expansion seemed to catch hold of the entire nation. The concept of manifest destiny, coupled with reports of fertile farmland, lucrative beaver trade, and abundant natural resources, including gold, spurred many to action. The fact that these lands were home to countless Native Americans and claimed by Spain, France, and Mexico seemed of little consequence. Today's guest author, Robert Morgan, looks at some of the key players in this history in his book, Lions of the West, Heroes and Villains of the Westward Expansion. In 10 short, gripping biographies, he takes readers on a roller coaster ride of highs and lows that combine to forge the dream of a nation stretching from coast to coast. The so-called lions Mr. Morgan writes about include Thomas Jefferson, Andrew Jackson, John Chapman, David Crockett, Sam Houston, James Polk, Winfield Scott, Kit Carson, Nicholas Twist, and John Quincy Adams. The book also provides a better understanding of why, in 1861, our nation could plunge into civil war. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Mr. Morgan. He is a professor of English at Cornell University and the author of poetry, fiction, and nonfiction, including his best-selling novel, Gap Creek. Mr. Morgan joins us by phone for this interview. Robert Morgan, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Oh, very good to be here.
Well, how do you take all the cast of characters that managed to be the heroes and villains of the Westward Expansion and get it all down to 10? Is there a set of metrics that you employed to get this done?
That was the difficult part, deciding how to limit it. The book had to be limited. It couldn't go on forever. And I had published, as you mentioned, a biography of Daniel Boone in 2007. My publisher asked, you know, if there was some way we could continue the story of the exploration of North America, the settling of North America. As we were talking about possible figures like Sam Houston, Kit Carson, I happened to mention to my publisher that the American leader who probably had the most influence on the westward expansion was Thomas Jefferson, who had always been obsessed with the West, what was over the Blue Ridge Mountains, beyond the Mississippi Valley. And, of course, when he became president, he commissioned the Lewis and Clark Expedition, really did something about exploring and eventually claiming the West. And then I said to my publisher, you know, the man who actually nailed down by treaty everything from Texas to the Pacific was Jefferson's grandson-in-law, Nicholas T. Twist, who nobody's ever heard of outside histories of diplomacy.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because I was going to have to admit that I had never heard of this guy. And as long as I'm in good company here, I guess it's okay. But, yeah, it's fascinating. Why don't you just go ahead and tell us the story of why Twist is so important? I mean, it looks to me like if it wasn't for Twist, the people living in Tucson would be living in Mexico today.
That is probably true. I think Nicholas Twist pulled off one of the great coups in American diplomacy. I don't believe anybody else could have done it, to tell you the truth. He had been Jefferson's law student, executor of Jefferson's will. He was fluent in several languages. He happened at the time of the Mexican War to be the chief clerk of the State Department. These days we would call him the Undersecretary of State, but then he was just called the chief clerk. Polk and Secretary of State Buchanan chose him to go to Mexico to negotiate with the Mexican government. And because Winfield Scott, the commander in Mexico, was a Whig, they wanted to bypass Scott and undercut him and send one of their own men to negotiate the end of the war. Of course, when Twist got there, Scott did not appreciate the fact that the chief clerk of the State Department had been sent down there to negotiate the end of the war without consulting him, the commander-in-chief of the Army. So they had a standoff for about 6 weeks, and then they discovered that they had a lot in common. They were both Virginians, they were both Essex, they were both students of history, and they became the best of friends. Twist, after the conquest of Mexico City, September 1847, began his negotiations with the Mexican government, such as it was. It really was a very unstable situation in Mexico, and in some ways it was hard to know who to negotiate with. I mean, who was actually in charge, but there was a committee assigned to negotiate with him. He basically charmed them because he understood a lot about Mexican history. He was fluent in Spanish. When his boss back in Washington, James K. Polk, saw that he had become so close to Winfield Scott, Polk fired Nicholas Twist and told him to come home. Well, Twist was asked by the Mexicans and by Winfield Scott and by these fine British diplomats who had facilitated his negotiations to stay on and to finish the treaty. They weren't sure that it could ever be done if it were not done right now. So, disobeying the president and the secretary of state, Twist, as a private citizen, stayed in Mexico and completed the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, signed by the Mexican government February 2nd, 1848. It's something of a miracle that that ever happened because Mexico had always been so opposed to ceding any land to the United States. So it was a tremendous coup. For $15 million, Twist bought what is now New Mexico, Arizona, California, Nevada, Utah, a half of Colorado, a little bit of Wyoming. Now, that was half of Mexican territory they lost in that one treaty.
Well, no doubt as to how he got in your book then. You mentioned James K. Polk, a president who doesn't get the acclaim that some others do in the 19th century. There is a recent book out by Polk, and I meant to bring it along just to see what you thought. But one of the things I found so fascinating about your discussion of his election is the mention of the immigration issue. And in that sense, of course, his party was taking the stand, I believe, that immigration should be open for those Irish coming over the Atlantic. And as you read it, you have this thought of, wow, history does repeat itself. Help us with that.
Exactly. The support of the immigrants was very important at that period and later, I think. This issue goes all the way back to Thomas Jefferson and the Federalists. The Federalists wanted a smaller, English-speaking, very English-like country. Thomas Jefferson looked across the Blue Ridge Mountains. He looked at the interior of the continent. He looked all the way toward those great harbors on the Pacific, San Diego, Monterey, San Francisco. And he believed that the future of the country was in its diversity and its multiplicity. He welcomed German immigrants, Irish immigrants, the Hispanic people, the Native Americans. His vision of the country was, to a great extent, the one that became true, became actual. That was one of the great issues between the Federalists of New England and other places, and Jefferson and his Republican Democrats at that time. Polk is continuing that. He also believes that there is a destiny, that it's his God-given destiny to expand the country to the California coast, because the United States will never be a great world power without those harbors on the Pacific. And that part of Oregon territory, north of the Columbia River. So he was negotiating with the British at the same time he was planning the Mexican War. We can be, you know, critical of them. We can feel morally superior. How do we know that we would have thought the same way at the time?
You're listening to Robert Morgan. He's the author of Lions of the West, Heroes and Villains of the Westward Expansion. Let's talk about that concept of manifest destiny. In your prologue to the book, you point out something that I must admit never really occurred to me. When I think of manifest destiny, I think of some president in a White House like Polk deciding that this is national policy, and I expect to read it in whatever the daily newspapers of the day were, and I expect it to be the official policy of the national government. But when you write about the lives and dreams of the Americans who made their way across the country, in a sense, you almost seem to suggest, you do suggest, that the leadership arose from the ranks and file of the people who made these journeys. And in a sense, the government wasn't leading them, but was following them. Help us with that.
I believe that's exactly true, that the West, whether it was Alabama, Kentucky, Missouri, Arkansas, California, Texas, or Oregon, the westward expansion was made possible by all the Americans and English-speaking people who went there. Government policy sometimes coincided with that urge, that hunger, that obsession with claiming that land. But the real work of the westward expansion was not done by the leaders and even the famous scouts. It was done by the thousands and thousands of nameless people to put their lives on the line, to go all the way to Oregon, to go all the way to the Great Valley of California, or to go down into Texas in the 1820s and 30s. And I don't think that's generally recognized. It really was the ordinary folks who did all this, who risked their lives, who did the hard work, and, you know, on the darker side, who killed the Indians in their way if they had to. It's a complicated story. Polk was very happy that those folks had gone to Oregon and gone to California and to Texas. That gave him an excuse. It made it easier for him to do the official expansion. Polk is a very interesting figure. He was absolutely humorless. He was a workaholic. Sam Houston said the problem with Jimmy Polk is he's a victim of the use of water as a beverage. he was ever drinking bourbon with his mentor Andrew Jackson and his friend Sam Houston. He was sipping water, but he's the only president in American history who did everything he promised to do while he was running.
In one term, right?
And he said, "I will never run again.
Yeah, that's what
give me one
yeah.
term, Amazing. And I will do four things. I will end the high tariff that's hurting the American farmers. I will establish a stable banking system, a financial system. I will acquire Oregon from the British, and I will acquire California." When he stepped down in March of 1849, he had accomplished all those things.
Why were Americans so hungry for that land as they moved west?
Because more and more immigrants were coming in, and there was no cheap land in the east. That was always the case. The cheap land was in the west, even going back to the 18th century, when the indentured servants, once they had served their time, moved back into the Appalachian foothills and down into Georgia and places like that. And as the country grew and grew, people were hungry for that free land. They heard, you know, what a wonderful place Texas was, and what a wonderful place the Sacramento Valley was, the San Joaquin Valley, and particularly the Willamette Valley in Oregon. And they had never had anything. Mostly these immigrants had never owned a foot of land, or very little, and it seemed there for the taking. There were just a few Indians in the way. They were unstoppable, no matter what kind of treaty was made. They just kept going. In fact, we are seeing the reverse of this in the past 30 years, of all the Hispanic people coming up from Central America and Mexico. If people want to go somewhere, they will go. You can't really stop them.
So we're talking about Nicholas Trist, and what a surprise that was to see him listed among all those folks that we know something about. There's another one, at least another one, John Chapman. Now, he's better known as Johnny Appleseed, but tell us about why you put him in there and what difference he makes in this westward expansion.
Well, one of the reasons I decided to put in Johnny Appleseed was I wanted one figure who didn't kill any Indians, but in fact was friends with them, but who had an enormous influence on the expansion into Ohio Valley and into Indiana. And, of course, I think he is a fascinating figure. A lot of people have said to me, I didn't know Johnny Appleseed was a real person. I thought he was just a creation of folklore, a creation of Walt Disney. But, in fact, he was a very real person, born in Leominster, Massachusetts, 1774, after the Revolution. His family moved into the Pennsylvania frontier. And from there, he moved across the Ohio and began planting apple trees from seeds. Of course, good orchardists do not plant apple trees, they graft them. Another surprise about John Chapman was that he thought of himself as a missionary. Besides planting apple trees, he believed he was spreading the gospel of Swedenborg, the gospel of the New Jerusalem Church. Of course, he got no takers. I don't think he converted anybody, but he was happy to pass around chapters of Swedenborg's writing and to give sermons and to talk about how he had talked to angels, and we were already in the New Jerusalem, if we could just see it. The Indians and the settlers looked upon him probably as a kind of holy fool. But I found him a very interesting man. He lived to a great extent out in the wilderness with the Indians, wouldn't hurt a mosquito, and was very wealthy because he owned a lot of land. He had bought a lot of land, which he left to his family.
Let's talk about Winfield Scott for a moment. He was credited with one of the great American victories that I don't think we really know all that much about, but he defeated Santa Anna, and the amazing thing about it, he did it in Mexico City. I mean, that's quite a ways from the border of the United States then. Tell us about that piece of history.
Well, Winfield Scott, according to the testimony of officers who served under him, say Robert E. Lee and Ulysses S. Grant, was probably one of our greatest soldiers. I found him a very interesting man. He was a scholar. He was a chef. He loved French cooking. He weighed over 300 pounds by the time of the Mexican War. Because he was a Whig, Polk almost tried to prevent him from conquering Mexico. It's one of the ironies of this period. He didn't want Scott to become a hero and then run for president against the Democrats. But Scott was an absolute master tactician. The Duke of Wellington, the most famous soldier in the world, said Scott will never take Veracruz. It's so heavily fortified, it has a fort in the harbor. Nobody can take Veracruz. And Winfield Scott moved his army and navy a few miles south of Veracruz, brought his heavy naval guns ashore, and from behind, practically blew Veracruz apart. About 3 days of bombardment, and the city surrendered. Now, in the War of 1812, he had mastered a technique which the Mexicans never seemed to catch on to, of demonstrating, that is, fighting a little bit in front of the enemy while he moved his main force and his artillery behind the enemy. Santa Anna said it would be impossible for Scott, going east from Veracruz toward the city of Mexico, to ever get past Cerro Gordo, because all the Mexican army and its heavy artillery were positioned on the Camino Nacional. Scott did a little fighting in front of the Mexicans. They thought they had won. They celebrated all night in a fiesta, their great victory, while Robert E. Lee, who was a topographical engineer, found an old mule route way around the mountain. And Scott moved his army and his artillery in behind the Mexicans and blew them to pieces. This is the greatest shame, as far as I know, in Mexican military history, that they were destroyed there at Cerro Gordo, just as they were celebrating their victory. Santa Anna was so frightened, he left his cork leg and fled on a mule west toward Mexico City. When the American army finally reached the Valley of Mexico in August 1847, Santa Anna put up a great defense just east of the city, El Cañon. Scott sent out a few skirmishers, and They were driven back. Fontana thought he had won again. Well, meanwhile, Scott was moving his army through the swamps and around the lakeshore to San Agustin, south of Mexico City, and then came from the south to attack in four battles at Contreras, where he pulled that same maneuver of sending his main army in behind the Mexicans, and then at Churubusco, and then at Molino del Rey. He lost a lot of men at Molino del Rey. And then the final assault at Chapultepec in September. The Duke of Wellington, who had said to Scott, it's hopeless, he couldn't possibly win that war. He had only about 5,000 fighting men. Most of his men were sick and really out of commission. But when Scott took Mexico City, the Duke of Wellington said, Scott is the greatest soldier in the world. And since the Duke of Wellington was still alive, that's quite a statement. But all the men who served as Scott testified his great patience, his tactical cunning, and his respect and recognition of the men who served under him, which is not always true with great generals. I don't, you know, give credit to the other people, but Scott was happy to do that. He was a great diplomat as well as a soldier. He had negotiated three treaties with the British over the Canadian border. In fact, he had earned the title the Pacificator. How many generals can you think who had ever won the title of the Pacificator?
You're listening to Robert Morgan. He's the author of Lions of the West, Heroes and Villains of the Westward Expansion. You know, one of the things that I think would be the toughest about writing a book like you did is separating legend from actual biography or history. And I assume that legend, even though historians do their best to sift through it and make sure they get the accuracy of the times, every now and then seeps into some of these stories. I mean, the Alamo, the story of the Alamo and Davy Crockett and Sam Houston, which you tell in this book, boy, there's so much legend surrounding that. Did you learn anything about, let's just take Texas and the Alamo. Is there anything, as you get into these things, you think, wow, now that's something that I never came across in my years of studying this event or American history in general?
Oh, again and again, I found out things I did not know. It is important as a historian to separate, insofar as you can, the mythology, the legend, the folklore from the facts. But it's also important to remember that the folklore is an important part of history, and the Alamo is a great example of that. We will probably never know exactly how Davy Crockett was killed at the Alamo. There are different versions. There have been fake diaries, you know, claiming he was taken prisoner and then executed. But what is important for history, what is most important, is that his death at the Alamo brought the sympathy and support of the whole world, practically, to the cause of Texas independence. So this mythic hero, this legendary hero, dying at the Alamo as a martyr, really had an impact on the history of that time and eventually on the annexation of Texas as one of the United States. But I don't think we will ever know for sure how he actually died. What's important was that he wouldn't leave. He had an opportunity to leave, and he stuck it out, and that made him a martyr. As I say in the book, it's as though Crockett had spent his whole life preparing for that role. Almost all of his writing about himself shows how he was a victim of misfortune, of bad weather, of bankruptcy, corrupt politicians. He almost drowned in the Mississippi, carrying a load of shingles, I believe it was, down to New Orleans. But that's the important thing, is that the legend of Crockett's death at the Alamo had a great impact on the course of Texas independence. And notice that even though he had disobeyed Sam Houston, commander of the army, refused to follow his orders, you never find Sam Houston disparaging Crockett in any of his speeches, in any of his writing.
Kit Carson's another Lion of the West that you talk about. He stirred up California settlers to fight for independence. How did this Indian fighter end up in California?
Well, I was really surprised as I studied Carson. For instance, I didn't know that he was illiterate. He was so famous, couldn't read or write. He learned to write his name, C. Carson, toward the end of his life, even though at one time he was a colonel and then actually a brigadier general in the Union Army. But he was a relative of Boone by marriage and born in Kentucky, grew up in Missouri, right near the beginning of the Santa Fe Trail and the Oregon Trail, was apprenticed to a saddle maker, hated that job, ran away from home when he was 16, down the Santa Fe Trail, and then to Taos, where he turned himself into a mountain man, and probably the greatest scout of his time. I can't think of anybody who surpasses Carson. He knew Indian languages. He knew Indian customs. He was fluent in Spanish. He was fluent in Canadian French. And my favorite understatement of this whole period of American history comes from 1842. John Charles Fremont has been commissioned to map the Oregon Trail. And he's on a steamboat going up the Missouri River. He meets Kit Carson, whom he's never heard of, learns that he's been a hunter, mountain man, and he says, I need somebody to guide me to the Rocky Mountains. And Carson, who was always a very modest man, said, well, I've spent some time in the mountains. I think I can take you where you want to go. Of course, he had a photographic mind for land. He knew the Rockies from one end to the other. He knew the Great Basin. He knew the High Sierra. He even knew the Valley of California. And he got to California with John Charles Fremont on his second expedition, and was there at the so-called liberation of California with Fremont and Stockton. He took part in that and then was commissioned to take the letters from those commanders cross-country all the way back to Washington, D.C., got to, I think it was Socorro, down on the Rio Grande, and ran into Stephen Watts Kearney, who was on his way to California to take part in the conquest. Kearney ordered him to go back with him to California. So he saw a lot of action. He was at the Battle of San Pascual, one of the main battles north of Mexico in the Mexican War.
So when you put this book together and came up with the 10, can I assume there were others that didn't make the cut? And is that volume 2 of Lions of the West?
I wanted to include a chapter on Thomas Hart Benton, the senator who was who was actually Fremont's father-in-law. I wanted a chapter on Tecumseh, the great Shawnee chief. And I actually wrote 3 chapters on women of the West. Sacagawea, who was with Lewis and Clark, Narcissa Whitman, who was killed by Indians in Oregon, she's a missionary, and Susan McGoffin, who as a bride went down the Santa Fe Trail just behind Kearney as he was going to claim that, Nuevo Mexico was now New Mexico. And she kept a wonderful diary. A lot of what we know about the Santa Fe Trail comes from her diary. I actually wrote those chapters, and my publisher said the book is already too big. We can't include them. So possibly, yes, another book on Lionesses of the West.
There you go.
Maybe. More heroes and villains of the westward expansion.
Well, I really enjoyed the book. It's just a great read. And again, for those of us living out in the West especially, it brings a lot of things home to us. You start putting 2 and 2 together is why things look the way they do. We really appreciate what you've done here. Robert Morgan, author of Lions of the West, Heroes and Villains of the Westward Expansion. Thanks for joining us today on Reader's Corner.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Robert Morgan. Next week, Mike Brown, author of How I Killed Pluto and Why It Had It Coming. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Kathleen Tuck. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.